Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey folks, this is Ben. This is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers, and welcome along to the first episode of 2018. For which I'm delighted to say my guest is Magnum photographer Christopher Anderson. Before I introduce Christopher, I have a couple of bits of housekeeping and an exciting New Year announcement. If you like the podcast, please scooch over to iTunes and drop off a brief review there. If you're a regular listener, please consider supporting the ongoing production of the podcast by signing up for a small recurring monthly subscription of roughly the cost of an overpriced cup of coffee, or make a one-off donation at bensmithphoto.com/asmallvoice. Finally, I am delighted to announce that this episode of the podcast is brought to you by the Charcoal Book Club. Yep, that's right, A Small Voice has its first official sponsor. What is the Charcoal Book Club? It is the world's first book of the month club dedicated exclusively to photo books. As such, I think they're a brilliant fit for A Small Voice. I'm sure you, as a listener, will agree with me. These people are photographers themselves. They're as passionate about good photo books as you and I are, and they care deeply about the books that they select. Each month, Charcoal works with the most respected photographers and publishers in the industry to send hand-picked books directly to your door. Whether you're a professional artist or photographer with a stock library or a novice who's just beginning to build their collection, Charcoal Book Club is an easy and affordable way to stay up to date on the most essential work in contemporary photography. The club offers free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US, and members get exclusive perks such as signed copies, access to rare titles and more. Here's the really good bit. As a very special introductory offer exclusively for Small Voice listeners, they're offering a free photo book to new members. Yep, a free photo book. Go to charcoalbookclub.com and use the special code ASMALLVOICE when you sign up to receive your free book. Once again, go to charcoalbookclub.com for the latest and greatest photo books delivered to your door with free shipping and no hassles. Inform the mind, inspire the soul. That, my friends, is some exciting stuff. So Christopher Anderson was born in Canada in 1970, grew up in West Texas, USA. In 2000, on assignment for the New York Times magazine, he boarded a small wooden boat with 44 Haitians trying to sail to America. The boat sank in the Caribbean. The photographs earned Christopher the Robert Capa Gold Medal and marked the beginning of a 10-year period as a contract photographer for Newsweek magazine and National Geographic magazine. In 2011, he became New York magazine's first ever photographer in residence. Christopher joined Magnum Photos in 2005. He's the author of four monographs and he is currently based in Barcelona, Spain. This was a fascinating chat. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. I suppose we could sort of start by talking about what you're up to, because you're going to do a talk about portrait photography here in London, and I guess you're not these kind of pigeonholes that can be useless and not helpful, but you're not primarily a portrait photographer. How do you think about yourself in that respect?
It's kind of a question has been on my mind a lot lately. How do I think of myself in that sense? So what pigeonhole do I stuff myself in?
Yeah, exactly. Or do you seek to avoid all that kind of stuff?
Well, I think for me the best way to describe it is there's some misconception about what it is that I do, particularly because my roots are in documentary photography, and I came from this, there was a time when I fit into a pigeonhole of war photographer, and I felt as equally uncomfortable about that pigeonhole or that term at the time. But the misconception seems to be that I used to be one kind of photographer, and I stopped being that kind of photographer and became another kind of photographer. And for me, even though perhaps the locations have changed, the subject matter has changed, the bag of tricks has changed a little bit. What I'm looking for in a photograph is still the same thing that I was looking for then. I think now when I'm making a portrait, I still feel like there's this the same thing that I want to come out of that image, the same sort of emotional impulse, the same sort of emotional impact. That's what I'm looking for. And I mean, interesting, one of the things that I had thought about talking about tonight as I was, you know, planning, reflecting on this idea of I'm a portrait photographer now. I think portraiture was always a part of the work that I did, even as a war photographer. And certainly documentary work informs how I make portraits now. And so for me, it's all connected. It's all a continuous points on the same path.
Yeah. So do you know what you're going to be talking about, or how the thing's going to be organized, or is it just off the cuff?
Well, I think Sabrina and I have discussed, had a conversation by telephone and sort of agreed on maybe things we might talk about and some images of mine that she was curious to know more about. I'm going to start by giving a presentation of some of my images, particularly those that pertain to portraiture.
Hmm.
And the images that I prepared are exactly what I was talking about before, this idea that you know, portraiture was always an integral part of the work of my photography, of the work that I made.
Yeah.
And so I'll show some pictures. You know, it's kind of been fun. I've been going back and editing some older bodies of work with an eye towards portraiture.
Hmm.
And
so you're looking at that stuff in a slightly different context to how you might have looked at it the first time around, as it were, or you're looking out for different stuff that you.
Well, I'm looking at things that you might look at now if you pulled it out of, you know, pulled it out of context of the body of work that it was shot in, and just held it up as an image of, in and of itself, and realized, oh, this is portraiture. This is I approach this in this making that particular image in the same way that I would go about now.
Mm.
Like I said, I mean, maybe I've learned a few more tricks and you know, maybe I do some things different. And certainly the way I see has evolved. At least I hope it's always evolving.
Mm.
But I feel still very connected to images that I made then.
Mm. Have you, talking about boxes of tricks, have you had to learn how to light stuff in recent years? Because you're one of those people, you're very self-taught, you didn't train formally. And as a documentary guy, it's one of those things you can kind of avoid having to learn. But is that something that you've kind of made a conscious effort to work with or figure out?
I mean, but even that part of it, I was always experimenting with, you know, we're always looking for the latest camera, the latest lens that's going to change everything for us, right? So yeah, I went, especially particularly at the moment in around I can't remember the year now, 2010, was it 2010? That I started this collaboration with New York Magazine, this sort of the residency with them, where a lot of what I was doing for the magazine wound up, ended up being portraiture, And because of the kind of magazine it is, I was sort of given license to, you know, do things that I wouldn't do before, go into a studio and make a portrait, try out different techniques, learn how to use some lights. And it was that part in and of itself for me was a fun exploration, just learning this whole new territory of technique and things like that. Even though I'm someone, in the end, I want the image to not be about the technique, but yeah, I was having fun experimenting with a lot of things. I find that I still don't really know how to turn on the machines that make the light. I feel like I know light very well, but I don't really know the machines that make light. So I rely on some very knowledgeable people who know how to turn those, you know, press the right buttons. But I know what I want from an image, and I know how to shape that, and I know how to understand how to read that light, I think. And most importantly, I know what it is that I want from an image, or I know how I want an image to be. Interestingly enough, though, now that I've played around with those techniques, I find myself using less and less of it and sort of going back photographically to where I started in technically.
Right. So it's almost that thing of, you know, you know, you can, once you've learned the things, you can then forget them again and kind of go back to almost a simpler, purer approach.
Yeah. And when the novelty of the trick wears off for you, then the freedom of being able to just do it the way you want to do it comes back.
Yeah. I think it might be interesting to talk about some particular pictures, but because you did that portrait of Chuck Close, that seemed to get quite a lot of, that portrait got quite a lot of, got quite a strong reaction, I felt. You know, people really responded to it. Did you get that impression? I know it was a cover shot, so, you know, it was, you know, quite widely seen.
People did seem to respond well to that picture. I did get good feedback about that picture, which is nice, because it is a picture that I like. So it's nice.
When you went into that session, when you went into that session, though, did you have a very specific idea in mind in that case, or did you just experiment a little bit? What, you know, in the course of actually shooting him, with different compositions and different ideas.
Well, that one is that's for me is a good example of how I might, when someone asks me how I approach portraiture especially in a commission sense like that. It was for the New York Times magazine, and you know, Chuck Close is a visual artist himself, you know, world famous photographer. And he's been photographed a lot, and his own artwork, his own photographs, and his own paintings deal with his own self-portraiture. So his image is seen a lot. He has interpreted himself over and over, and those images are well known. And then other photographers, many excellent photographers, have also sort of reinterpreted him interpreting his own image. So. What I wanted to do was not make, from a visual standpoint, I knew that I wanted to make an image that didn't, repeat the way he is often photographed. So I thought long and hard about how I might photograph him so that it just, you know, visually could be different. It could look different. What's the angle? How, you know, and usually he's photographed very straight on, looking straight into the camera, which is the way his work is. It turns out he's difficult to photograph him from a side profile perspective because of, you know, he's in a wheelchair, and the apparatus of his wheelchair comes up high behind his head, and so just logistically, it's a difficult thing to organize into a frame. But more importantly, I wanted, as I always think about when I go into making a portrait, I think people, you know, there's certainly, I go through the steps of thinking about lighting and technique and what sort of framings and techniques I might apply to visually to it. But more than that, I go into a portrait wanting to find something that feels, not looks different, but that feels different than what I've seen before. Because I want the viewer, when looking at a picture, to sort of feel my experience. And how do you get at that essence of what it feels like to be there, to be in this person's presence, not just to make a pretty picture of this person. Is really my goal, is to source, to somehow get at this idea of what it feels like to be there. And so I knew that I wanted to be very, very close to him when I photographed him. I knew that, you know, I was thinking a lot about his eye and you know, how he sees the world you know, and even sort of this person who represents, in terms of art and the life that he's lived, a certain earned wisdom, I don't know, all of these things that play in the background of your mind as you're making a picture. And I hope that that then informs the moment that I make the picture. Did I go in knowing that I wanted to crop part of his face out and that I wanted to have that particular kind of light? No. It was more about how I wanted to approach him,
right,
and what I wanted the photograph to feel like. That's what I thought about most.
Right.
I'm sorry if I'm rambling.
No, you're not at all, man. That's brilliant. I think that's exactly the kind of thing I was looking for. And obviously, I think I might pull that picture out and put it up with the interview so people can see, because not everyone will be familiar with it. And one of my listeners did point out that if we're talking about specific images and he's driving in his car, he can't check while he's listening to the podcast.
And don't do that.
Yeah. So it's good for, no, but you know.
The other interesting side of that is that the picture that's on the cover of the New York Times Magazine is not the same picture that I choose as sort of the memorable image from that. And it's one of these interesting things I've done a lot of, you know, I work a lot for magazines, and I know the needs of magazines very well. So I totally agree with the choice that that the New York Times Magazine made for that the frame that they chose, where you actually see he's actually looking into camera,
right?
Because it makes sense as a cover of a magazine. It is the clear choice as a cover image. The image that I personally like is something it's more of a slow read, and it's a quieter image, and it's where you can't see his eye.
Right,
And so that's why people I've been asked the question a lot, like, why are there these two versions of this image out there? Well, one is it was the cover image, and right. It made sense to be the cover image. The other one is my image.
Yeah. So there was a slight kind of difference of emphasis there, but like you say, they've got their own kind of agenda in terms of what works for the cover. So I want to get the kind of origin story as I often do. Your dad was a preacher.
Yes.
You are a preacher's son.
I'm a son of a preacher man.
You had a very religious upbringing, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And, you know, is that something that you ultimately pushed against or wanted to move away from? Do you still have any kind of religious faith, I suppose, would be the obvious way to put it.
Yeah. How long is this interview? We'd need a couple of 8-hour sessions, I think, to fit all that in. But I'm not religious now. As any young person, I think there were moments when I rebelled against my family, against my father. Maybe it had something to do with the religious part. Maybe it didn't. I don't know how to separate those things now. I certainly at some point, rejected the the official belief structure of religion, and that was a traumatic thing to do, because you're not just rejecting, oh, am I religious or not? You have to make a statement about basically everything you've been taught,
right,
growing up, yeah, of how the world and how the universe works. But at the same time, yes, my father was a preacher, and yes, I grew up in a religious, very religious context. But I also have, unlike a lot of particularly evangelical religion that I see today, I have a tremendous amount of respect for my father's and my family's faith.
Right.
Because what I saw in them was a particular faith. So I don't reject their faith, certainly.
Mm.
But the religious part of it, yeah. Was,
yeah.
How does it be? We're talking about photography here. And I think my upbringing certainly informs my photography. I think it is subconsciously and even sometimes very consciously a part of every image that I make. And I don't say that in sort of in a, I don't mean to try to sound overly poetic about that, but yeah, it was a powerful force that shaped me in many in many ways, and continues to shape me.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering, you know, your early experiences, you know, in conflict photography and seeing the kind of worst aspects, and indeed the best aspects of you know, human behavior. I'm wondering, was that instrumental in the decision that you kind of ultimately made, or had you already moved away from you know, kind of religious your religious upbringing at that stage?
When I was photographing in conflict zones,
yeah.
I mean, by that part of my early adult life, I think I had already formally moved away from religion. I've never really thought about this. But,
we can get off this.
Yeah,
no.
But it's interesting. Now that you're bringing up many thoughts and emotions about it. I think I'd officially moved away from religion, but I was. You know, the idea of going and then photographing suffering was always always rolled up and confused with different ideas of morality and ethics and then sin, and good and evil and all these kinds of things. Yeah. I'm not sure I've thought about it quite specifically enough to sound coherent about it right now. But that's like I said, my upbringing, my past definitely informed at the time the work I did and how I thought about the individuals in my pictures. What I wanted my pictures to do. What purpose I thought I was serving in this whole scheme of things.
Okay, so look, I think we should kind of figure out how you got to that point, because, you know, in your sort of your bio, what people often, you know, the thing that gets referred to a lot is this thing that got you a lot of attention initially, which was in Haiti, and you traveled on a boat with some refugees, and the boat sank. I guess that was almost, do you see that as the start of something, or, you know, was there stuff before that, you know, that was important, you know, in terms of the way that your career developed in the early days?
That was definitely the start of something. And at least that was the, you know, it's a long story. I don't know how to tell this. I don't know how to even talk about this without the context of the story, but I mean, basically, I was on a boat with immigrants, Haitian immigrants, trying to sail to America, and we We sank in the Caribbean. We were rescued by the Coast Guard. And yeah, the pictures that I made of that event were formative in the sense that I began making pictures at a moment when we literally thought we were not going to live much longer.
Mm.
And I thought for a long time about this afterwards, like what was the point of that? You know, why would I do that?
Yeah.
And the only answer that I could come up with was for myself was had something to do with, you know, this idea that the pictures were had as much to do with me explaining the world to myself as it did explaining the world to someone else in a journalistic sense. And I knew that event crystallized the idea of what I wanted pictures to be about, what I wanted my pictures to do, which is this idea of communicating something about an experience, communicating something about an emotion, and for them to not transmit information, to report information, but to communicate something that was much more emotional and much more intangible. And even today in a portrait, that's still the thing that I want to be communicated in image. That's what I want the image to be, to contain.
Right. Yeah, I think you've said, you know, you've said several times that you never really saw yourself as the sort of, you know, objective or the kind of conventional picture of a photojournalist, as someone who's trying to be objective or trying to report, you know, facts or whatever, that you've always felt that your work was more subjective than deliberately and knowingly subjective.
I don't believe in objectivity.
Yeah.
I don't believe in facts in that sense. Mm. I do believe in truth. But, you know, we go out here on the street and have everybody on the street witness the same car accident from different angles, and everyone will have a different story about what happened. But there'll still be an essential truth of what happened, and that there was a car crash.
Mm-hmm.
That's a stupid analogy, but...
No, not really.
But... Yeah, I don't believe in this. Especially when it comes to photography, this heavy thing of photographer. Now, certainly there are news photographers who perform a function to be objective, and I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about my role when I worked as a photojournalist. I wasn't going to be a reporter. I saw my role was to go and to make a comment on something. A subjective comment. I was, in that sense, I was working as an editorialist, as an editorial columnist, mm-hmm. To put it in those terms, not as a news reporter. So my work had to be subjective, but you needed to know that, you know, it wasn't, I wasn't trying to slip it under the idea of false objectivity, I guess.
So you won the Kappa gold medal for that set of pictures, which is you know, I guess probably one of those things that photographers who do that kind of work, you know, might aspire to win. Did it mean a lot to you to win that?
Yes, certainly.
Because I know you've sort of...
My parents came to the ceremony and everything. But, yeah, it was...
Were you aware of the sort of illustrious company that put you in terms of the kind of people who'd won it prior to you?
Yeah, oh, I was very aware.
Yeah.
James Noctaway was an early mentor of mine, and, you know, I looked up to him very much, and I knew very well what the medal was about. I'd even seen one. He'd shown me one of his. So it was a big deal at the time, and was also helpful professionally at the time. It's not something I don't know. It's in a drawer. It doesn't. Well, it's not. Awards are nice, but I feel so uncomfortable talking about an award.
Well, I have heard you say that you're one of the people who generally feels that maybe there's too many of them, or that they're an unnecessary, part of the game.
You're trying to get me in a lot of trouble.
No, I'm not. Okay, let's move on.
No, I will speak about that. I think the photo world, particularly the documentary photo world, is obsessed with awards, and they're a necessary tool for young photographers to establish their name, and they're certainly nice to receive. And the ones that have money attached to them are helpful to continue doing the work. But I don't know. The whole idea of even that we call it the awards season, and it's all these things to enter and congratulate ourselves about and pat ourselves on the back for doing this good job. It's something about it I find obscene in the end. I know I'm going to be, I'm a hypocrite, but I'm someone who benefited early on from those awards, so I'm even uncomfortable talking about that in that sense. But we're really good at patting ourselves on the back.
But I don't think you're a hypocrite. I mean, I think it's possible to have benefited from that and to be able to criticize it at the same time. I mean, I don't see any problem with that. It seems like a contradiction, but. I don't see there's any problem with that at all. But you kind of said that you kind of literally woke up one morning and realized you were a professional photographer. I don't know how literally you mean that, but do you remember a particular point? Because I guess the point you're making is it's all kind of happened by accident, or it happened at that point, or to that point by accident.
Yeah, what I really mean by that, actually it's not too far off, but I never... made a plan. I never had a plan that I was going to be a photographer. I never went to school for it. I didn't, map out a road map of how to get where I was going. There were a series of events, and that doesn't mean that I didn't work hard at different, didn't work hard at my profession, didn't have an ambition, those kinds of things. But I never, it didn't occur to me that there was a job called photographer until I literally was working as a photographer. And having no educational background in it, it's a long, boring story, but my first job, I kind of literally fell backwards into having a job as a newspaper photographer with no photographic experience and no journalism education. And it was sort of dumb luck. And then here I was as a photographer. I thought, oh, this is fun. And I learned to be a photographer. And that took me to another step that, an opportunity came before me. And I did an assignment for a magazine, and then one thing led to another, and I did another assignment. So there was never this conscious idea of setting out and saying, that's my goal, I'm going to go there and become that. It wasn't until, and especially of what kind of photography I would do, and ending up in a war zone was literally a series of events that, came one after the other without any foresight of what would bring me to that point. And it wasn't until quite late in my career when I began asking myself very basic questions like, what is a photograph and why do I take pictures and what do I want my pictures to do and how will I, how do I want to make my pictures and these kinds of things. That wasn't a conscious thought until I was deep into actually doing it and kind of woke up one morning and thought, oh, I better, this isn't just because it looks cool. I've got to think about this.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple of your book projects. was Capitolio was before Sun, right?
Yes, yeah.
So you did this project in Venezuela, which became the book Capitolio. What was the genesis of that project? What took you there?
In around 2004, this was after a few years of post September 11th, post Haiti boat. After September 11th, then finding myself in kind of going from one place to another where, you know, bad things were happening and people were suffering and kind of wanting to escape the region that I had been photographing a lot in, which at that time was, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, the Middle East a lot, Central Asia. And at the time I was on contract with Newsweek magazine. And so I knew there was going to be this vote about the presidency of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And I didn't know anything about Venezuela or Hugo Chavez or anything, but I thought, oh, it's not Iraq. Yeah. It's not Afghanistan. So I got myself an assignment from the magazine to go to Caracas and photograph this referendum that was going on. And I got caught up in the place for many reasons. Things, you know, a time in my life of needing to escape, a time in my life of needing to take different kinds of pictures. Well, I don't know, but I found myself there photographing in a way that looked different than what I'd been. I was seeing something different. And I began going on my own and refusing assignments to go because I kind of, for the first time, discovered this freedom of taking pictures without any thought of a client or a magazine or really anything that I was required to tell as someone.
So this was really your sort of first experience of a kind of a personal project, as it were, or what became a personal project.
But I hate even using this word personal project because it sounds so trite. It was really about a way of existing, a way of being that was total freedom of going out with my camera and photographing the world and seeing the world and experiencing the world on my own agenda, on my own terms, and without any thought on the back of my head of, oh yeah, I need to get that picture for the magazine, right? And it was enlightening. It was so liberating. It was this thing that I had I was discovering this thing that I had said on the Haiti, you know, looking at the Haiti boat pictures. I'm making these pictures that are about this experience that I'm having. I'm making pictures that are about what I'm feeling today or what I'm witnessing, and not at all about reporting of information.
Yeah. So you had that kind of liberation.
Still, that total liberation. But I got caught up in making pictures there. So I wound up going repeatedly and staying for a long time over the course of the next 4 years. And I guess, as I was there, there was this news story going on. So I was sort of following that as a journalist only to myself because I wasn't working on assignments at the time. To do it, I got a grant at one point and would save my money up from other assignments and to go there. But what I realized, these pictures that I was seeing, that I was making, were they looked like the photojournalism that I had been making, but they didn't say the same things. In the end, the book to me is sort of a statement about as much about the idea of photojournalism and objectivity and subjectivity as it is certainly any story about Venezuela. It's not a story about Venezuela.
Yeah, right. So part of the point of it was to explore that whole question of objectivity, subjectivity, what is photojournalism, all that stuff. Was that part of the kind
that
of
was thing? Very much the point. Yeah. In its book form.
Mm.
The pictures are very dark and obscure and really that's part of my lack of understanding what was going on, because I still don't know what's going on in Venezuela. I didn't understand then.
Yeah.
And the pictures surely don't explain anything about that place.
No.
The whole thing was confusion to me, but also, I was lost. I was getting lost somewhere.
And yeah, you didn't put any text in the book. There was no kind of supporting. There was nothing to kind of explain anything. Obviously, that was a deliberate decision, I presume. You know, a very kind of considered opinion, considered decision.
Yes.
What was your thinking?
You know. I didn't somehow putting a text in there would felt to me at the time like it would make it polemic. It would make this book into a work of journalism, which I have fought, which it wasn't about at all. And so there is text in there, but it's text that I stenciled and then mm. photographed, because I also, there was a whole other thing I wanted to experiment with sort of in my head. The book was always a short film that I just happened to be making with still images. And so I felt like text, printed text would somehow break this rhythm of continuous forward movement in the book that felt somehow cinematic and like a film reel. In fact, when I've exhibited it, I've actually exhibited it as just like one long string of pictures all connected together, because it was meant to be viewed that way, not as page after page of look at this nice picture, then now look at this nice picture, but really as the picture is there because it completes the image before it, and it, you know, somehow brings forward the image that comes after, you know.
Mm-hmm. I saw a thing where you were sort of talking some students through the sequencing, which was really interesting, because I was, you know, it's always, I think the way the pictures are sequenced in a book is always a kind of fascinating subject, and I'm just wondering if, was that really your first experience of having to do that, to sequence images? Because that was your first book project. I mean, how did you, you know, how did you go about learning, or was it just instinctive, that particular kind of skill, as it were?
Ooh, I don't know. I mean, certainly I'm informed by the, you know, I inhale photographic books. That's where I learned photography, basically, is looking at how other people have sequenced books. But in the case of that book, I think I was more informed by cinema, really,
right,
than photo book, because I actually was fighting against this notion of photo book as I was doing it a lot. You know, I open, in a cinematic way, I open with sort of this, I imagined the camera, you know, flying into to the place of where our story takes place, and you know, we're getting an overview as the credits are rolling at the beginning of the book, and then boom, we open with an action sequence, that, and then we go from this action sequence into being introduced to our characters that play part of this role, and we build to a certain crescendo at the end, and we end with sort of a you know, dot dot dot
right.
To be continued ending, so right. to speak. So in my mind, really, was very much about cinema, but in many ways that book was being sequenced in my head over the course of 4 years while I was photographing it. And when I actually sat down to edit the thing, and you know, for years I had the pictures up on my wall, all in little small prints, with little with magnets up on my wall, looking at them for years and moving them around from time to time. So the sequence had been happening for years in my head. When I actually sat down and said, I'm editing this book, the actual edit came out in a matter of days because it was it had been cooking for so long, you know.
That's a good way of of thinking about it.
But I have to say, speaking of sequences, that I just was looking at Xavier Barral's book about the making of Exiles of Joseph Gudelka.
Oh, really?
Which is about the whole process of editing and sequencing that book. And it really is a magnificent masterpiece for young photographers. Go out and look at this book. It is...
Exiles.
Really, the book Exiles, of course, but there's a new book called The Making of Exiles, which goes through Joseph and Delpierre's editing of Exiles, and it's a masterpiece.
That sounds like you could have a hell of a learning curve just by looking at that. Let's move on to Sun, because I'd love to talk to you about that. This is a book that you basically which followed Capitolio, but a very different type of project. Very personal project. Pictures of your lovely young fella, just after as a baby, I guess, really. It was the first 2 years of his life, essentially, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't think it didn't start intentionally as a project. It sort of became one. Do you remember, I mean, you know, in a sense that you were just taking pictures as a dad kind of thing rather than as a photographer. Do you remember how it kind of morphed from that into being a project? In your head?
Yes. This was at the moment it was, I was editing, when my son was born, I was editing Capitolio, which was sort of this book that was my farewell to journalism.
Right.
And sort of already my farewell to, you know, me as the photographer in dangerous places kind of thing.
So you'd already kind of made that call, as it were, before...
I already knew as I was editing Capitolio, I could never go back to photojournalism in that sense, in the sense that I had worked at as before.
It wasn't becoming a dad that caused you
but
to...
But then at that same time, also having my son. And... realizing that not only could I not work in the same way in the very, you know, reportage sense, but that I was not going to go back to the war, the wars or whatever, however you want to say it. And I was just sort of at this kind of transitional moment of my life, and having spent my entire photographic career running away from, you know, the preacher boy in Texas to go to the far ends of the earth to photograph the exotic of something around the globe, and that was what everything in photography was about to me up to that point. And then all of a sudden, here I am faced with this new life of my own there, and Ben began photographing that really in a way that any father would. You just, the fact that I actually was a photographer was really beside the point. It was like, oh, there's my baby. I'm going to photograph my baby. And without any other thinking beyond that, in a very organic way, my father also became very ill about this point, and I made some pictures of him. And, you know, as naturally as we do, you start thinking about cycles of life and death and, you know, really obvious universal themes. But it still was not this idea of, oh, I'm making a work about this now. It wasn't till about 2 years into photographing my son that it dawned on me that this was a body of work, and it was okay for that to be, that not only was it a body of my work, it was my life's work. Everything I'd done before was just to prepare me to make these pictures that I'm making now.
Yeah, I've heard you say that before, and I was wondering if you could kind of talk about that a little bit, or you know, kind of explain what you mean.
Well, it took going off to the far corners of the world to make me understand the value of this, my own photographing of my own place, of my own experience. It took Capitolio and me sort of having this break with the reporting idea of photography to sort of allow myself to take, if my photography really is about something about experience and emotion, then my photographing my own family in that sense really is putting my money where my mouth is, I guess. But it was also, I recognized in the pictures this thing that I always wanted to be in my pictures, which was something that felt very, I don't know.
Intimate?
Intimate, yeah. And real. And you know, emotional.
Mm.
And you know, I struggled with publishing the book at the time because it was, you know, seemed weird to show. Even when I finally decided we're going to do the book, it was strange to show pictures of my family like that, something that was so very intimate. I'm not sure I would do it again the same way, but it was also about 2 years into it. It was at the moment that I realized that this is a body of work, and not only a body of work, but is my most important body of work, my life's work, that I also knew that I had to stop doing it as a body of work.
Right.
I continue to photograph my family, of course, even pictures of my family become, you know, show up in different places.
Yeah.
But as a concentrated, I'm doing this book about my family, I had to stop it at that point because as soon as I was aware of that, it totally changed how I was seeing.
Oh, right. Okay.
And
okay,
the pictures, I kept trying to go a little bit further. The pictures started.
So you lost something somehow.
I lost some innocence to it. I lost some sort of spontaneity and really just something that was very ephemeral and authentic, you know, in that sense.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
I mean, I think I have it now because I don't plan any book with the pictures I'm doing now. They happen, you know, and I let them happen. But you know, as soon as I recognize, oh, this is a body of work. Okay, now this is a book, and I couldn't take any more pictures because the pictures just didn't work right then.
Mm.
So if there is a, to me, the beauty about that book is it does contain. It's flawed as a book in many ways, and how I now think of how books should be organized, and you know, there are mistakes, but it's sort of its mistakes to me are its charm, and its naivety is its charm.
Authenticity, I think, is partly maybe the word that you know we should use. I would use. But of course, the fact that your dad was unwell at that time gave it that extra depth, because the son was you, of course, as well. You know,
yes.
It was about you as a son as well as you as a dad and your son. Did you have to persuade your wife to? Because she's
to get naked.
She's the other. Well, precisely. I mean, she's the other main character in the book, and you know, and she is quite often naked. And then you had to sell it to her that you're actually going to put those intimate pictures in a book. Was that a difficult sell, or was she generally pretty okay with it?
It's a difficult one to answer. Well, let's just say she has a certain comfort with herself. She's French, and there's a certain bit of the revealing of the body that you know, the French have more comfort with, perhaps, than other cultures. So there's that. She also, I think she, in many other contexts, would not have been cool with it. But I think she really understood that at that time, she understood the naivety of it all. She understood that it was something that I was doing and had to do at that moment. Mm. And the night that I was about to go on press for the printing of the book, I remember I woke up in a panic and just like, I can't do this. And I called her and I was like, I'm stopping this book right now. I'm not going to do it. We can't do it. She's like, you know, no, you have to do this. You have my approval. And you know, besides now all a lot of these pictures have already been seen anyway. So, right. So it's too late now, but you know, now I think about it, I would be more careful now, mm-hmm. Than I was at the time. But at the time it was a weird moment where it was something that, I don't know, I can't describe it. She was okay with it because she understood it. How about that?
Yeah. Well, we should mention that she's in the business, as it were, because she's a photo editor herself. So in that sense, she sort of at least has some kind of inside understanding of, you know, kind of perhaps the photographer's mindset and whatever.
Yes.
But also you had to negotiate this kind of, you know, what's a kind of modern problem for all of us, which is, you know, to what extent do you show your kids, you know, social media? Do you put pictures of them on Facebook? All that stuff. In a way, you were sort of having to deal with those issues, you know, and wondering about... You know,
I wasn't quite dealing with social media the way it is now.
Right. But it's a sort of similar thing that you were going to be, your kids, you know, the pictures of your kid were going to be very public and, you know, published in a very, you know, in a formal way. And he was only, you know, very small.
Yes.
So maybe in that sense, you know, it was less of a worry. But clearly not old enough to make any kind of a decision himself as to where, you know, as to what he would want, you know, I guess.
Yeah,
you
know. I'm probably going to be, you know, paying some therapy bills for him at some point. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it was terrifying for me, you know, this moment that I realized that, which is why I stopped publishing more work of him at a certain point. But although I have published a picture or two here and there, but you know, I remember the first time he was old enough, we were in a bookstore in New York, and he, you know, he knew about the book already, he'd seen the pictures, but this idea that there was a book out in the world with him, and he saw the book on a shelf, and he you know, found it, pulled it off the shelf, and he was super proud. And it was this, you know, you can imagine my immense relief that he would react to it that way. Not like, oh my God, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
Maybe that's going to be to come when he's a teenager, we'll see. But
I don't know. I think he'll probably still enjoy the fact that there's a book of him when he was a baby. But yeah, you talk a lot about sort of, you know, trying to cut through the noise, really, and you know, the challenge of producing images that do that in this age of massive kind of, you know, image overload in a way. Could you talk a little bit about that and how, you know, one might be able to even attempt to do that with pictures? I don't know, you know, you have to say, you know, you want pictures, you want to feel like you've been punched in the gut kind of thing. But that's a remarkably difficult thing to achieve, to get, you know, for a photographer to make images that have that impact.
It's certainly something I think about a lot, and I don't know if I come to any conclusion or insight, but this idea of how, you know, in a world where we are inundated, we are drowning in images, how to make a photograph, how to make an image that cuts through that noise. And I don't know if I have any great insight into that, except I know what works for me. No, I don't. I think that when I, the only thing that I can think of is a formula that might help for me when I'm making pictures is the idea of making something that truly feels like it could only be me. That it is, I'm talking about authenticity, something that feels authentic, that feels truthful. When I know I'm not lying to myself, then perhaps I might get lucky enough to make an image that resonates somehow with someone else. What makes some images connect and others not connect? What's that magic dust that gets sprinkled on something? Man, it's enough to wake you up at night.
Yeah. I mean, this might seem like a weird question, but do you think that if you have a body of work, say you a book project, that, you know, works as a single piece of work, as a cohesive kind of narrative or whatever, do you think it matters if the pictures as individual pictures are not necessarily all that good? Have I phrased that in a way that's understandable? In other words,
let me rephrase it.
Yeah, rephrase it.
I don't really care about good pictures.
Oh, well, that's a good answer. But that seems like a contradiction if we're talking about your attempt to.
Yeah, I mean,
the ultimate thing is to have a great cohesive body of work and great individual pictures. That's the goal, right? If you can achieve that.
Yes.
But it seems like you're saying that it is okay if the individual images are not necessarily all that brilliant, you know.
If we're talking about bodies of work.
Yeah.
And for me, that would usually mean a book. Mm. Let's say a book. I really am not interested in the party trick of the great picture. Yes, I like looking at good pictures as much as anyone. Yes, I love that image that cuts through the noise. That we're talking about something else right now. I'm talking when I think of a great books that come to mind, it's more about what the book has to say.
Right.
It's more about how the book makes me feel. It's more about this thing that transports me somewhere. And in that sense, the idea of good photography or bad photography, it's meaningless. That said, I like seeing good pictures as much, but what is a good picture?
Yeah, exactly.
I do think in the world of, you know, this is sort of the golden age of book publishing, and I think a lot of photo books these days have taken what I'm saying to the extreme, where there's nothing, it's about design and the tricks of design, which sometimes there are nice and have their place. But it's more about design than photography. Mm-hmm. And, I love when a good body of work speaks on its own, and I don't need a heavy handed design to grab me by the nose and point out the obvious to me.
Right.
Now I'm talking.
No, that's great. I mean, yeah, that was a brilliant answer to what I thought might have been a terrible question. I appreciate it. It's brilliant. But this thing about the intimacy, I mean, I think, you know, it's something you've said, and you know, it really involves engaging with people, doesn't it? You know, in terms of your subjects, some of us find that difficult because we like to just, you know, it's like, oh, I don't really want to have to deal with anyone. Do you know what I mean? Like, but what do you have any good examples of in your own work of that could illustrate the point that you're making, really, about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, when I say something that's intimate, I'm not exactly always the most sociable person myself. I'm not, I tend to like being alone and being quiet.
Mm.
Intimacy doesn't mean you have to, you know, get to know every detail about someone. But when I say intimate, I mean that I want to feel the proximity. And that proximity is not just physical, but it's about, you know, your awareness, your understanding, your connection to something. Not, you know, not that you became best friends with the subject.
So, does that make sense? Yeah, totally.
An example of...
You sort of said, you know, you don't want to be this sort of just this shadow that passes through and stops... you know, stops a scene, as it were, that you want to feel, you know, kind of engaged and connected, I think.
I don't know how I could say an example of my own work. I always use this example. For me, photography, the interesting thing about photography is not that this light is perfect and you have the little person in the background perfectly silhouetted against the horizon, and then the hand coming in the left side of the frame and the person in the foreground doing, you know, that part of it is all a party trick. That is, it's some people do it better than others, but after a while it's the same trick. That's not the thing that interests me. What interests me in photography, good photography, bad photography, is this idea of looking through the eyes of someone else, of getting this chance to be inside someone else's head and see what they see. That's what is beautiful to me in photography. That's what is interesting to me.
Mm.
And not how well this person learns to repeat a trick that someone else did and performs that same circus trick. No, I want to see the world the way someone else sees it. And when I've taught students, the analogy I always make is this movie Being John Malkovich, you know this movie?
Yeah.
And you know the point of the movie, they go to the seven and a half floor, I think it is. And somewhere on the seven and a half floor, you squeeze out of the elevator and you're inside the head of John Malkovich and you get to go and look through his eyes. And that to me is the analogy of photography, this idea of you go to the seventh and a half floor and you're looking through the eyes of someone else. And that is understanding how their brain works and what they think about and what they cared to notice. That's interesting to me.
Mm.
Whether that's, and there's an intimacy in that that's not necessarily about how much time do you spend with this person, that person?
Right.
I think if I were to give examples of my own work, I can think of pictures that I never even met the person, but the experience feels intimate, maybe. Or oftentimes, even though I didn't meet the person, there's an exchange somehow. There's, you know, there's something that transpires between me and the subject. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I also am not saying that intimacy should be about everybody's photography. That's what it is for my photography. Certainly, Gursky is not about being intimate, you know? That's not what is interesting in his photography. That's not what is the point of it. So I'm not saying that everyone's photography needs to be intimate.
No.
For me personally, that's what I find interesting.
Yeah, and I think I'm always saying it, but on the podcast. But there's the nice thing about photography is such a broad church. There are so many different types and different approaches, and you know, there's room for everyone. There's room for your approach and the Gursky approach, and you know, it's like just it's horses for courses kind of thing. You know, it's just what you're into. I'm with you. So, I want to talk to you a little bit about Magnum. I like to collect the how I got into Magnum stories. So you could tell me that one. How did you? Where were you when you got the phone call? I'd like to know about how it felt to get the nod that you'd made it, because it must be quite a, you know, I mean, clearly it's going to be an exciting moment. Do you remember?
Yeah, mine is not so interesting. And they all become apocryphal in some way or another, including my own, which I've heard At least two other photographers described the exact same thing that happened to me. Which is that you know, the vote was very close, and Martine Frank cast the mysterious extra vote from, you know, Cartier-Bresson or whatever, and who was not in the room, but she has his extra vote, and that's how you got in. I know I've heard Alex Soth say the same thing, and literally I was told the same thing too. So I assume it's this apocryphal thing.
But, I like that though. No one's told me that one before. Yeah. So yeah, thank you for.
But otherwise, it's not that interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess what is interesting is that you have some close buddies who are already in the agency, and. It was almost, that was almost the attraction for you, that, you know, it was, you would sort of, you know, going to be with your mates, which seems like as good a reason to want to do something as any.
Yeah, that was, as much as anything, that was a part of it for me. My close friends at the time, from doing the kinds of things and going to the places that I was going to at the time, was a close group of friends, Alex Maioli, Thomas Dvorak, Paolo Pellegrin, and at the time Ilkka Huiminen, who, you know, we were all very close friends, and I knew them. In fact, Thomas and I were friends from before either of us was in Magnum. And Ilkka as well, and Alex. Alex was already in, I guess. But my friendship with them was built outside of Magnum and grew outside of Magnum. And so then there was a time when I wanted to be with them. I was with Seven. I had joined the agency Seven at the time. Which had just started, and like I said, Jim Noctaway was a mentor of mine, and so was Chris Morris and Antonin Kratochvil, people that I looked up to very much and to this day love very much and respect very much. But I was the young person in that agency and wanting to be with my immediate peers to sort of grow old together with them was to be part of that experience was what I wanted at the time.
I'm just wondering if the sort of famous Magnum process, whereby you go through various stages to full membership, I'm wondering if kind of going through that helped you to decide what kind of photographer that you wanted to be, or did it help you kind of come to some realizations about your own kind of work or your own approach?
Yeah, that the most interesting part of the Magnum process is that it is a context that forces you to confront certain questions about what you do and why you do what you do and how you do what you do, and not that it's not possible to have that, to be faced with those questions outside of the context of Magnum, but that process is a very concentrated context where you have no choice but to face these questions. And for me, in that sense, was extremely helpful in sort of grappling with this idea of what am I doing and why am I doing this? It sounds all super existential, and I don't want to mystify that whole thing any more than it is. It's very practical sense of answering for yourself these questions.
Yeah. And no, I can imagine
not that. Just coming up with a good answer that sounds good in this in this interview,
but to actually
think about it and deal with it yourself.
And I presume it's kind of quite inspiring to be surrounded by, you know, those people who you admire, and, you know, some of the old guard. Are there certain people who you go to, you know, for input, for feedback, or are you very sort of self-contained in the way that you operate?
I have a very close continued friendship with several of the photographers that I had before I came into Magnum, and that continues, and that we can, you know, we have a 20 plus year ongoing conversation of our work with each other. And recently I was just in China with Alex Maioli, where we got to continue this that conversation in a very concrete way of actually making pictures together. Was
oh great.
Was amazing. Yeah, and then the idea of, you know, sitting next during the Magnum meeting and sitting next to Joseph Kudelka at lunch, it still to this day gives me the shivers. You know, it's like I still get goosebumps when I think about it. You know, Elliot Erwitt, Bruce Davidson, you know, these people whose work, you know, to be able to you know, Susan Mizellis, man, you know, a wealth of knowledge, amazing new book she just came out with. You know, it's, yeah, that is quite rich. And doesn't, that part never wears off. I mean, that, yeah. Some of the other things get annoying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, famously, but of course it is. You know, yeah. It's going to be. There's always going to be the good and the bad with that sort of situation. Well, thank you so much for talking to me, Christopher. I really appreciate you making the time, mate. And it's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope things go well with the talk tonight. And you know, we'll keep an eye on everything that you do in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you.